Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey out there, rock and rollers. Welcome to episode number 113 of the Ugly American Werewolf in London Rock Podcast, brought to you by me, your host, Mac B. the Wolf. And I will be joined very shortly by my partner in crime and co-host, as always, from the East Coast of the U.S., Gary Action Jackson. And though we were sorry to have to make it, we hope that you took the time to listen to our Jeff Beck tribute last week. Kind of sad that we have to do these tributes to legends that we are losing. And God, as we recorded this, we just lost another, David Crosby, here not that long ago. And while it may not be shocking that he passed away in his 80s, actually kind of shocking that he lived as long as he did, it's still sad. And it's a good time to remember all the great stuff that he did, both in the Byrds and with Crosby, Stills, and Nash, Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young. And I'm just glad that I did have the opportunity to see him play with Crosby, Stills, and Nash a few years back. Maybe not at their prime, but they could still sing. They still belted out those classic tunes, and he had a beautiful voice. He maybe didn't make all the right decisions in life, but he was still a real talent. It's always a sad thing when we lose a talent like him. So happy trails, Cross. I hope that you are at peace. But we appreciate you listening to our Jeff Beck piece, and hopefully you heard the bit from Deborah Bonham and Peter Bullock on their time touring with him on the Stars Align tour, and the great anecdote from Peter about playing through Jeff's rig one day and maybe messing with the minds of the crowd waiting outside. But we got some good feedback, and then obviously a lot of people have offered their condolences to Jeff's family and his friends and fans, of which there are legion around the world. This week, we want to do an artist spotlight on someone who you might not know that well, though I bet you are familiar with a few of his songs. Okay, 1978, January 19th, Jerry Rafferty released the album City to City. Now, many of you might not know Jerry Rafferty, but I bet you know the hit single off of it, and that's Baker Street, which features that kind of sexy saxophone at the beginning and really kind of throughout it. But the signature riff, if you will, is a sax riff, not a guitar riff, not a piano riff, but a sax riff that Jerry did, in fact, write. Big hit, been used in a lot of movies and TV shows over the years. And Jerry had before been in a band called Steeler's Wheel, which had the big hit Stuck in the Middle with You. And everybody knows that one, especially if you are a fan of Quentin Tarantino's. You saw it in his first film, Reservoir Dogs, in a pivotal scene, which we'll talk a little bit more about here on the show. It's kind of easy listening, kind of that AM gold that we grew up with in the 70s. But there's great tunes on there. He had a great voice. And it was the highlight of his career. It was a big seller, multi-platinum, around the world, big hits on it. After that, he continued to make records, but nothing achieved the success of City to City, and as it's having its 45th anniversary, because it's something that Jackson and I kind of grew to love a little bit in college when we lived together, we thought we'd share some of those memories with you and go through this album track by track. But before we get to that, we have a little bit of business to take care of. Of course, we are members of the Pantheon Podcast Network, a network of about 100 different music shows with something for everybody. It's not just rock, but there's stuff out there for everyone. And we like to give shout-outs to the folks who we've had on or we've been on their shows in the past, like the CEO, Christian Swain of Rock and Roll Archaeology, like Martin Popoff, History in Five Songs, like our sister, Christy Alexander Hallberg, and Rock is Lit, like our dear friend, Paul Stevenson of This Day Rocks and Vintage Rock Pod, like Jay at The Hook Rocks, and like the Kiss Kings themselves, Tom and Zeus of the Shout It Out Loud cast. They're all off to good starts in this 2023, and I encourage you to check all of them out. But what you really need to do is go check out our sponsor, rarevinyl.com. I know a lot of you are record collectors out there. Rarevinyl.com has over 250,000 pieces in their inventory. And it's not just CDs and LPs. They've got singles. They've got DVDs. They've got posters. They've got tour programs, sometimes with the ticket stub. If you're looking for something special for your collection, go to rarevinyl.com and use code PODCAST. Use that code and you can save 10% off not only your first order, but every order you make with them. So for you collectors who like to buy things on occasion or you're always looking for a few things, check them out. Over 250,000 things in their inventory. They ship all around the world, and they take great care of their stuff. I've been to their warehouse. I have met their team. The way they procure this stuff, the way they catalog it, the way they rate it, and the way they ship it to you is all top-notch. You will not go wrong. Go to rarevinyl.com. Use code PODCAST. Save yourself 10%. Now back to Jerry Rafferty. Yes, as people who love hard rock and heavy metal, maybe we have to take a little guff for liking somebody like Jerry Rafferty or pointing out his great songs. But we're not the only people who liked him. You know, the Foo Fighters liked him. Dave and Taylor Hawkins really liked Jerry Rafferty. At least they liked these couple songs. They did cover Baker Street. And at one of the tribute concerts for Taylor Hawkins, I believe Mark Ronson came out and led a group to do Right Down the Line, which is the second big single off City to City. So you can be a hard rocker, you can be a true rock and roller, and still appreciate the greatness and the songwriting mastership and the sweet, delicate voice of Jerry Rafferty. So that's what we're going to do here on show 113, guys. We're going to talk about Jerry Rafferty's 1978 classic, City to City, right here on The Wolf.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shouted Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Yeah, man, you're dedicated. You are a dedicated co-host to the show, and you deserve all the credit in the world. For Lee, at 5:15, you leave the house at 5:15 in a suit with your hair looking good. I am impressed.
I got 10 pounds of product in there. It's ready to go.
That's nice.
DOT compliant.
Very well done. Very nice. So as much as we revered Jerry Rafferty and his songs off this album, it's kind of shocking to me that... I mean, if you told me in college that one day you two are going to have a radio show, because that's the only way we would understand what a podcast was, right?
Right.
It's a radio show that goes out on the computer. Oh, okay, yeah, whatever. You're going to do over 100 of them, and none of them are going to be on Jerry Rafferty. I'd be like, bullshit, man. It's going to be one of the first 10, you know? But, you know, we've just had a lot to do here, and as City to City, which is his biggest record, and certainly the one that we're most familiar with, is turning 45. This week, we would have put it out for its 45th birthday, but Jeff Beck passed away, and we just figured, well, let's do a tribute to the legendary Jeff Beck, and then City to City will be there. But, I mean, other than us digging Baker Street and Right Down the Line, mm-hmm. when we would have those easy listening times in college. Like, it wasn't all AC/DC and the Cult and Metallica and the Rolling Stones and Led Zeppelin. Sometimes you have to turn the volume dial down a little bit, right? The man cannot live on heavy metal and hard rock alone. And so he filled this nice void. But other than that, I mean, how did you first come to know Jerry and particularly those two songs?
So, like you were saying, when we were in college, it was a steady diet of hard rock, and I remember, I think we found him before. I'm 99% sure we found him before Reservoir Dogs, like before Steelers Wheels, or before we figured out what that was. If I remember the story correctly, there was in Orlando where we were in college, there were like two rock stations. One of them played stuff from the 70s, 80s, and then one of them played the new stuff. But it was all the catalog wasn't very big. But at night, there was a station out of Tampa that played a little bit funky mix of stuff. And right down the line was on there. So like we'd sit there and be like, okay, go back to that Tampa station and see if we can hear that. And it was just – that song in particular, it was just funky enough to listen to and enjoy. Mm-hmm. But it was definitely on the – I guess they hadn't coined the term yet, but yacht rock side of things. Yeah. I think we were yacht rocking before it was – info.
Yeah, I would call it adult contemporary or easy listening, certainly easy listening. And we would, of course, make fun of, before we knew what yacht rock was, we would make fun of it. You know, of course we would, because that's just what you do when you like hard, heavy rock and this, you know, Christopher Cross comes on, you're like, oh my God.
I was just going to say, Ride Like
a Wind. Yeah. Now, I can't say that I really knew that it was, somehow in college, we figured out that it was Jerry Rafferty. Like they played Baker Street or they played Right Down the Line. And said, and that's Jerry Rafferty off his City to City album. I'm like, oh, okay, that's Jerry Rafferty. Now we know to look out for him. I have to say that before that, growing up, I may not have known who Jerry Rafferty was, but I know those two songs because my mother was an adult contemporary fan. Okay. And so my dad was the rock and roller. My mom liked a little country, not super country, but she liked like Ann Murray and she liked, you know, Juice Newton and she liked the Eagles, you know, and I didn't like country. I knew from a very young age that I did not like country, you know. It's like, so I may not have had any power in the car over the stereo system with her, but I'm like, eh, I don't want to listen to country, mom. So most of the time she would listen to this, I think it was Wacky, W-A-K-Y, that had a little mix of oldies maybe, and then some of this easy listening adult contemporary in Louisville, Kentucky. So I end up, and you know, you would hear Neil Diamond on there, you know, like Coming to America, and some of those songs were on there. Love on the Rocks, you know, that was a big one in the car. And I just remember hearing these songs a lot. And obviously, anytime you have one enormous hit, you are going to get a second song. You're going to get another single. Right. It's just going to happen. Right. The record company wants it. The radio station's one of the fans are like, this is one huge song. There's got to be another one. So Baker Street, huge, huge international hit. But you got to have a follow up. And that's Right Down the Line, which is the next song off the record. Mm-hmm. And I just remember the two of them being, you know, I wouldn't put one above the other as a kid. I'm like, those two were kind of the same. As we kind of move along into maturity and get to know these songs better, Baker Street's the enormous hit because of the sax solo and the guitar solo, really, and the greatness of the song. But as a young kid, I didn't really discern between the two. I'm like, those are two great songs and they belong together.
Did you know that it was the same person or the same artist?
I didn't know it, but I could tell. Kind of thing, you know. Okay. Yeah, it's kind of like when I first heard "You're So Vain" by Carly Simon, and I can hear who I think Mick Jagger is, Mick Jagger on the back of vocals. I'm like, God, I know that's Mick Jagger. I believed it was him. Then I go find out I'm right, you know, kind of thing. I think that's that's kind of. But no, I didn't know his name until we got to college.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I know those were the two big ones, and I didn't grow up with that. But then going back and hearing the adult contemporary, yeah, those are the two big ones. And then, of course, you know, Stuck in the Middle with You came back around again because of Reservoir Dogs.
Right, and you can't overestimate Reservoir Dogs' value to that song in pop culture or in popular – in the zeitgeist of people. Like, had I heard that song before that movie? Yeah. Absolutely. Did I know who they were? Not at all. And the thing that not only helped it was, not only was it such an iconic and horrifying scene with Michael Madsen torturing the cop because he's singing to him and he's dancing around before he's going to cut his ear off, right? But it's K-Billy's Super Sounds of the 70s Weekend, which they talk about as characters in the movie, and it's Stephen Wright. And he even announces that, you know, the song is like this, you know, Jerry Rafferty and Joe Egan had pop duo Steelers Wheel with, you know, with the song. He's like, oh, I love this song. And then he goes around, and thankfully they pan away when he's actually hacking, but we know what's going on.
You ever listen to Kay Billy's Super Sounds of the 70s?
It's my personal favorite.
Joe Egan and Jerry Rafferty were a duo known as Steelers Wheel when they recorded this Dylan-esque pop bubblegum favorite from April of 1974. That reached up to number five as K. Billy Super Sounds of the 70s continued.
And the great part about that scene, not to get too off track, but it does not go together. Like the song is just this mellow kind of, and he's just, you know, just doing the, like you said, he's got the razor out. He's kind of dancing around. Like, you know, what's
he's a psychopath.
You know,
yeah.
Yes. He's going to do something very, very bad to this person. And it doesn't work, but it totally works in the movie.
Yeah, I know. And the thing is like people say, well, you must have seen Reservoir Dogs, you know, and heard that and then known it was Jerry Rafferty. I'm like, honest to God, I think I saw Pulp Fiction first.
I think
Pulp
so
Fiction.
Too. Yeah, because I know
it was 1994.
I know I didn't see.
I think.
It.
Yeah, well, yeah, I know yeah. I didn't see Reservoir Dogs in the theater. That's for sure. I think
right.
I'd heard people tell me, you know, there's this movie Reservoir Dogs. It's pretty darn good. I'm like, yeah, okay, whatever. You know, I'm not going to go rent it. But Pulp Fiction was huge for us in college, and we had to see it several
right.
times in the theater, including at the Draft House, which is a great place to see a theater. I mean, to see a picture, especially like that. And then eventually it's like, well, you know, there was this other one that came before it, Reservoir Dogs. I'm like, oh man, this might, in some ways, this is even better. You know, I mean, pretty darn good movie making and tough guys, gangsters, good use of music, mm-hmm. good use of putting time backwards and forwards and stuff. Like, yeah, that's really good. And when they said Joe Egan and Jerry Rafferty, like, oh yeah, that's Jerry Rafferty, who eventually went on to be a solo artist who did that those songs that we love so much. So that's mm-hmm. kind of where it all rests, as far as I'm concerned, as far as the ebb and flow of Jerry Rafferty coming in and out of our lives.
Yeah, interesting, because well, I was going to say, this is another one that doesn't really make sense. But if you listen to the rest of the show, we should not like this, but it's just a great record, and all of the songs they're a little bit different. And the one thing that I was thinking of is I don't think we've done a review yet on an album where it's just one person, right? I don't think. Like everyone else, it's like, you know, words and music by a couple different people mm-hmm. or the whole band. He wrote this all himself. So it's interesting to see how, you know, he puts all these songs together on his own and then he gets musicians in to record them. But one mind thinking of these.
Well, yeah, no, that's a good point. And we'll bring that up later because there was a lot of controversy, as they say in the UK,
ooh.
Around Baker Street. It's like, where did the melody from the sax really come from? And there was a little bit of back and forth on that over the years. And I think it's finally been resolved. It's Jerry who wrote every bit of it, and he deserves all the credit. But I do want to kind of go through a little bit of his career leading up to this point, because it's interesting, and it's a little different than most of the bands and the rockers that we end up following. But you say, right, on paper, we wouldn't do this. Well, on paper, would Dave Grohl be a fan of this? Because on paper, you know, he hangs out with Lemmy and has been in a hard mm-hmm. rock bands or whatever. But he liked this song. They covered this song. The Foo Fighters did an amazing version of Baker Street, you know? So,
yeah.
Look, it's one of those things that
transcends.
Yeah,
yes.
He's a little older than us, but he was probably like a senior when we were in the eighth grade or something like that. He's not like a generation older than us. He's just like a
right.
little. So
he's like older. Yeah, he's like older brother.
Exactly. You know, so like, yeah. I bet his mother heard it, listened to it on the radio when she was driving him around when he was growing up. And that's exactly where he heard it, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, it's the story of an Irish immigrant family who made it to Scotland so they could find work. And his dad was a laborer who worked very hard, and he was the youngest of three boys. And, you know, a typical Irish family didn't have a lot of money. It was kind of certainly pre-TV for people of that social class, and maybe you didn't even have a radio. So Irish families, what they do is They get together and they sing. They don't turn on the radio. Mm. They don't click on the TV. You sing in the house. And I think that was kind of part of his life growing up, was singing with his family. His mother was a pretty good singer, and singing with his brothers, kind of figuring out what harmony was. Like, but the bit you're singing is a little bit different from mine, to his older brother. He goes, yeah, it's called singing in harmony. And then within time, Jerry kind of figured that out. And so kind of, you know, to call them working class would almost be generous. I think they were kind of lower class, you know, living in housing, government housing or whatever, and or council estates, they call them. And then his dad died when he was only 16 from hard life and from alcoholism. And Jerry's like, look, you know, it was always music. For me, I was, you know, I may have had different jobs growing up, but it was never like, I'm going to make a life out of this. It was always, I'm going to make a life out of music.
Yeah. And I think that goes along with a lot of people that are musicians that, you know, you grow up around it. It's not like it's kind of in your soul. Mm-hmm. Like it gets into everything that you do. And I think that's probably what helps you write songs also, you know, cause you kind of think the experiences you have in your life, it just translates to music easier when it's always around you. And that's what a lot of these songs sound like to me, like he's taking pieces of his life and putting music to them, yeah, or at least concepts.
They're very personal songs.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. a lot of times when you hear a song, it sounds like he's singing it to a woman, or he's singing it to someone, you know, it's about them and I'm telling you what your right. life is about. But to me, if you really think about it, I think these are all him singing about himself, and maybe even to himself, like he's trying to explain himself to himself almost.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, yeah, just kind of giving the play-by-play of his life and where he was at that point in time.
So he's grown up in Scotland. He gets down to London, you know, with his buddy Joe Egan, who would of course be in Steeler's Wheel one day. And, you know, they're playing on the weekends. They get into a group called Mavericks with an X. And they're doing, you know, cover songs and stuff like that. They're busking in the London underground, you know, trying to earn money. They do a couple of singles, but they don't really go anywhere, you know. So nothing really happens with the Mavericks. Nothing happens with Joe Egan. So he happens upon Billy Connolly, who is a legend. He is a comedian and an actor, but he's kind of a Scottish national hero, Billy Connolly.
Yeah.
And for a few years, he's in this band called the Humble Bums with Billy. And for a while, there's this guy, a guitarist, Tam Harvey, but he wasn't, I guess eventually he kind of split after they got, maybe after the first album, or maybe even before the first album. But you know, they're playing, it's a little bluegrass, because I think that's what Billy's good at, is a little bit of banjo and maybe strumming a little bit of a guitar. But, you know, they made a few records, and they had some cool covers by a Scottish artist called John Byrne. And, you know, they had a couple of songs that got on to the radio around here. But it was kind of apparent that Rafferty was the real singing, songwriting, musician talent of the band. Even Billy said that. He's like, look, I know songs, and I still do, but I'm not a musician, and I won't be. But Jerry was, you know, and my hope was kind of like he would make me better, and he did, but then he also got better. So I never bridged the gap, you know. It's like he's still just always, you know, these few steps better than me. And he said in this documentary that I was watching right before we got on here, that he's like, you know, he is on every one of my songs in the Humble Bums, but I'm not on any of his songs because he was a perfectionist, and that's what perfectionists do. They perfect things. So he would get his songs down. And then when I would go into do mines, he would split and take off, maybe go to the pub, but then he could come back later and fix stuff or change stuff on my stuff. But the thing is, Billy, he's such a sweet guy. At least he's always seemed that way to me. He's like, did he do the right thing? Yeah, I think that he probably did. Now, you won't hear a musician say that ever. You know, you never say, Tony Iommi say, I'm glad that Ronnie James Dio went in after me and Geezer left and changed some things on the live. You will never hear that. You know, you will never hear anybody say that. So, I mean, it just shows that Billy is a humble man, that he has love and respect for Jerry, and he knows his limitations. He's like, I like singing and songwriting, but it's not my profession. It's not my greatest gift. I'm not what Jerry was, basically.
Yeah. And that's gotta be, I mean, I know Billy Connolly from his comedy,
right,
and, you know, speaking tours, but I can imagine somebody who has a passion for doing this And you think, okay, you know, I can write songs. And then you meet somebody like Jerry and just say, not like this. Like this person, they have it. Like I'm kind of a casual part of this, but this is somebody who really can knock it out of the park. And yeah, kudos to him for realizing that and realizing that what he was going to do to the music was going to make it better and not mess it up.
Exactly. You know, and he was getting a lot of compliments from a lot of people that his songwriting is somewhat McCartney-esque. You know, he's got that going for him. So when it came to, like, I guess they had one more album due to Transatlantic Records, the Humble Bums did, basically said, you know, it's okay if you just want to do a solo album to fulfill that contract. So his first solo album, which is 1971's Can I Have My Money Back, was that album, you know. And a lot of people said, you know, it's pretty good. You know, you can definitely see where he's going, and he's somebody on the way up, you know, on the rise there. I don't think it did a whole lot of damage, but you can see they made videos for it back in the day, or at least a video for the title track. And it's interesting to see a fresh-faced Jerry, who was still very young at that time. I mean, you know, early 20s, singing. Now, he doesn't look like a rock star, really. And then even once Baker Street comes out, you know, in 78, at the height of disco, yeah, where you either look like a punk and you looked horrible like street trash, or you looked like a disco diva, like someone in ABBA or, you know, someone like that, someone amazing. He looked like a guy who, you know, sat at a desk all day. I mean, that was just the way he looked, you know. So it may not have run up the charts, but he then got the opportunity to go back to his old buddy Joe Egan and create this duo called Steeler's Wheel. And I guess, I didn't know this, they recorded three albums with American songwriters and producers Lieber and Stoller. So that's interesting to me, because it's like, where did they find them, right? Mm-hmm. And how did they get the idea to do that? But, you know, obviously in their debut album, 1972, they put together Stuck in the Middle with You. Now, it didn't come out as a single till 1973, but it ran up the charts. It was at number 8 in the UK, number 6 in the Billboard Top 100. So that's a bona fide hit.
And I know they've got kind of a freaky video for that too, with their this random, you know, what are you saying, you know, clowns to the left of me. There's all stuff coming in, and I think it's in a big room or something. So I don't know what that was for, because it was before MTV. So I don't know if they had like television shows that they would show it right on. Would they play it in a club? Or I have no idea what it was for, but it was some kind of promotional deal.
Yeah. Did they have the old gray whistle test back then in the UK?
Yeah, I don't know.
Did they have Top of the Pops? I don't know all the shows and when they started and all that kind of stuff. But it's interesting, you know, and it sold over 1 million copies, you know, worldwide. So that's pretty good. I mean, that's success, you know. But I guess in dealing with these Lieber and Stoller and getting into this record, and they made three records through the 70s from like 72 to 75, but then it's like they were owned by them. It's like they couldn't, they were stuck, they were contractually obligated to them. And so, you know, from 1975 to 1978, Jerry was unable to do anything new. He couldn't go out and be Jerry Rafferty. I guess they didn't want to do Steeler's Wheel anymore. But no, Steeler's Wheel was 72. Fergus Lee Park was 73. Right or Wrong was 75. Neither of the second or third albums had a huge hit on it, like Stuck in the Middle. And so I think, you know, they wanted to move on, but they just couldn't, which is sad. And it's just, you know, so telling of the music industry. It's such nonsense.
Yeah. And it's unfortunate that you've got a situation where he probably had things that he wanted to work on, but you know, you're just kind of stonewalled, because if you do, you're going to get either sued or somebody else is going to own them.
Yeah. You know, but it also leads to, if you are this good of a musician, everybody says you're this talented of a songwriter, you can make these great tunes. If you've got 3 years of backup, when usually you've got to make a record every 12 to 15 or 18 months, then you've got 3 years of nothing. Then you're going to have a backlog. You're going to have some good stuff, one would think, there, you know, and nothing's more telling than George Harrison's first solo album, All Things Must Pass. He keeps writing these songs and they're like, okay, that's good, but it's not as good as what John and Paul wrote. So you can, you know, just hold on to that one. And he did. And he held on and he held on. And then they'd say, okay, the Beatles are broken up. Here's a triple album of stuff that I've written, including My Sweet Lord and What Is Life and all sorts of great stuff on there. So We come to late 77, early 78, and Jerry's making city to city. He's making it to London, but he's also commuting back to Scotland, you know, where he has a home, he has a wife, he has a daughter. And so I think that's where a lot of the big track and the title track, where the stories come from, is that he's kind of got this life. He's not touring, but he's got a life of jumping on trains and crashing in people's houses while he's trying to create something special that sold, 5.5 million copies or something like that worldwide?
Yeah. And I think that was part of his issue, too, was that he wanted to have this life with his family, but then also make music. And those two things are very hard to do. There are two worlds that are hard to get along with. You can't really have both. And he was trying to bridge that gap. And you can, if you go through these, you can tell, you know, he's excited to be making music, but also, you know, heartbroken that he has to make that choice to be away from them.
Yeah, it's easy to think that it's a glamorous life to be on the road, but what it is, it's a really hard life. Mm-hmm. And it's one thing to see the Rolling Stones on private jets and 5-star hotels. Most people are not the Rolling Stones. Okay. And if you're a singer-songwriter that looks like Jerry Rafferty, he's probably playing clubs and theaters with a backing band. You're on buses, you're on lorries, you know, you're on trains and stuff like that. And you know, once you get a hit, everybody wants a piece of you.
Right.
And he never wanted to be famous necessarily. He certainly didn't want to be on like Tiger Beat magazine or anything like that. He wanted to be known as a songwriter, and he won awards and things like that for it. But I just don't think he ever really reconciled the fact that what he did required a certain public presence, if not a public persona, and that's just something he never seemed to really be interested in.
Yeah, and the toll that it takes on you, and I would imagine too, if you were in Steeler's wheels, you know, there is a kind of, even though he was doing the bulk of the heavy lifting, there's a 50-50 kind of thing. Now it's all you. Nobody wants to talk to anybody else in the band except you.
Right.
You've got to do all the press. You've got to do all the, you take all the accolades, but you also take all the criticism when people don't like your stuff.
Right.
So yeah, I think this was a new phase that he was in, but you have to be able to take the whole thing.
Right. Monetarily, it probably worked out fine, but then having to do all the interviews and listen to the negative feedback and all that, I think Henley got sick of that as a solo artist, right? He's like, it's great that I don't have to bargain with Glenn or Don Felder or Joe about, you know, which songs are going on, all that kind of stuff. But it's like, every bad note, that's your fault, Henley. Every T-shirt that doesn't look right, that's your fault, Henley. So he's like, when like 1994 came back, he's like, I kind of like the idea of being in a band again so we can share some of this, right? Because monetarily, it's great to be a solo artist, but you're kind of, you know, table for one most of that time.
Yeah. And the other thing too is, you know, for as much as you were talking about, you know, fighting with the people in the band, when you're on your own, you don't have that person who's your equal to say, this is not good, do it again, or we're leaving this song off or whatever, you know, and then, you know, it, like you said, now it's your fault that for whatever reason it didn't work. So yeah, it sounds great on paper, but I think it's tough to take all by yourself.
Absolutely. I think you're right about that. But you know, he's a talented guy, and he produced the album with Hugh Murphy, and it's got 10 solid tracks on it, plus a B-side that we can talk about it. So I figure let's go track by track here.
Hi, I'm Paul Stevenson from Vintage Rock Pod, and you're listening to The Ugly American Werewolf in London.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/Pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
Okay.
And before we do that, a bit of research that I had no idea about, absolutely no clue about at all, is that the US version was sped up just a little bit compared to the UK version.
Okay.
Same identical 10 tracks, but if you play long form UK, it's about 53 minutes long. If you play long form US, it's 51 minutes and 12 seconds or something like that. So just being slightly faster, it shaves almost 2 minutes off the time of the record. Now, because I'm living in Europe and I don't have all, because I have this on CD and on LP back in America, I bought it on LP in the early 2000s, basically when people were throwing away their records, right? I mean, I think I got it for $1 or something like that. Like a first, I don't know if it's first run, but is it Jerry Rafferty, City to City? I remember buying it thinking, one day I'm going to reconnect with Jackson. He's going to love this, right? And, you know, just thinking, geez, I can't believe I can get this for $1 right now. But I don't have it to compare, you know, so I don't know. And if you go on YouTube, I think it's the British version. I think it's the original. But back, we'll come back to that later. The first song is The Ark.
Mm-hmm.
Not what you would necessarily expect to kick off a record. You know what I mean? It's kind of folksy, kind of bluegrass or country, or very kind of Scottish, Irish, folksy kind of
traditional.
Kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's some fiddle in there. Something I obviously didn't know before doing research, that opening bit features the Australian bush band, the Bushwhackers, who were playing fiddle and concertina and bodhran on there. You can hear some mandolin. Even the guitar solo is a little muted. It's kind of a pretty song, but it's weird for me as far as this is how you start the album.
Well, and especially when you had more upbeat numbers in there. Yeah, it is strange. But I think I don't know him personally. I didn't get to talk to him before this show, but I would imagine that he led that off like with that kind of traditional music to kind of set the mood where that's where his head's at. Like he's, even though he's a rock star and a big deal and everything else, he's still a country boy from Scotland. Mm-hmm. And hearkening back to that, maybe.
Yeah, and it's a pretty song. It's kind of long. It's 5.5 minutes. But honestly, I mean, I think the shortest song in here is 3.5 minutes. Most of them are 4.5 to 5 minutes. So at 5.5 minutes, it's a little long. It tells a good story. I mean, you're talking about a ship to carry us away, but so obviously it's the Ark. I'm not going to say I don't like it because I do like it, but as many times as I've listened to this record, I always thought this is just an odd way to start.
The thing that struck me is when he goes in, if you didn't know anything about this and you just heard it stone cold, he sounds almost identical to Jackson Browne for the first couple of
you think so?
The refrains that he has. I think so. Yeah. He's got that, like, it's the, what he's saying and the way he's saying it, I could easily have mistaken him for that. It is kind of a strange way to start, but yeah, it's very inspirational. I don't know whether he's talking about his family coming together or what the message is, but yeah, I would have thought this would have probably been farther down on the album.
Absolutely. Especially when you've got a couple of bona fide hits and then a couple of upbeat, I don't know if I call them rockin' songs, but more like travel songs, you know, like road trip type songs. Like, why wouldn't you start with that instead? But we can come back to that. It's a nice song.
But again, he's not only is he writing everything, but he's also producing. And so, I mean, did someone say something like that to him? Like, no, man, come on. You want to hit him hard right off the bat. Nope, this is what I'm doing. I feel this is the best way. All right, you're in charge.
See, the dark night has come down. But now we know that we can wake up from this sleep and set out on the journey, find a ship.
Well, apparently United Artists, the record company, is like, City to City, the title track, that ought to be the first single. And he's like, no, it's Baker Street song. That's what you want to put out. That's the best song on the record. Like, no, that's too good for the public. Let's give them the City to City song. Like, what do you mean too good for the public? What does that even mean? It means we shouldn't play it for them? Are you nuts kind of thing? But City to City would make a good opening track to be honest with you, because you kind of want to kick it off and get it going. But look, you don't have to wait too long. 5.5 minutes in, now here comes Baker Street, the enormous, enormous worldwide hit, number 3 in the UK, 4 weeks at number 1 in Canada, several weeks at number 2 in the Billboard Hot 100, and 2 weeks at number 1 on America's Cashbox Top 100, released in February 1978. Before we get into more stats or the controversy about it, I mean, what does this song mean to you? What does the recollection of hearing this song do for you?
I could swear that I came to this second after Right Down the Line, and it's just...
Yeah.
I mean, again, if you've never heard this before, it kind of starts off a little slow. You know, it's got that, you know, melody to it. Mm-hmm. What I like at the beginning are the, if you really listen, there's splash cymbals or something. Mm-hmm. Like bang, you know, he's doing them in the back, bang, bang, bang. That's the other thing about this record. There's a lot going on. Like, if you listen to it, there's a lot of parts. It's very layered. Mm-hmm. And it kind of starts off a little slow. And then that sax comes in and just rips it up. And then it like, it's like you're... You know, it's like the roller coaster. You know, you're going up, 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 and then, you know, you hit the big dip when the sax comes in, and then you're into the song and rolling.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And yeah. There's a lot of people who play on this album. It's not just like 3 or 4 guys.
Oh yeah, there's a ton.
There's a ton of people on there. And they might not be household names to our American fans or even some people in the UK, but I mean, to some of the Scottish people, like Barbara Dixon, she's one of the most celebrated songstresses and singers in Scotland. I think she's been given, you know, an OBE or some kind of, you know, honorary award or something like that. And she's singing backup on this. And, you know, eventually Jerry went and played on some of her records, you know. But the sax solo in here really does kind of define it. That melody is huge. Played by Raphael Ravenscroft, who we talked about not that long ago when we did Robert Plant's Pictures at 11, because he played on Pledge Pin. And he played on, I think, Pink Floyd's Final Cut. He's played with some other folks that we know. But for years, there were controversy because he claimed that was really something he came up with. Like, Jerry didn't give me a finished song and say, play this. There were gaps in it. And some of that I borrowed from some blues stuff, you know, and I had an alto sax with me, so I went ahead and played it. Jerry always said, bullshit, that's not true. You know, in fact, I didn't even want it as a sax solo. I was going to do it as a guitar thing. And then, what's his name? The producer said, well, why don't we try it as a sax thing? And Raphael was around, so they did it that way.
Okay, so what you're saying is that the music was already written. And instead of being played on a guitar, it was just switched to the sax, or, you know, however they do it, transpose it or whatever. So it wasn't like he came up with it. He just played it as instructed.
Right. And that's what Jerry said, right?
Okay.
But there was a little he said, she said for a long time. Well, eventually, you know, it came out. There was a demo that came out that was recorded before the final version was recorded. And it is, I didn't think it's Jerry playing it on the guitar with a little bit of echo and stuff on it. So it's obviously, and in that same documentary with Billy Connolly, he's like, if I had to guess, I would say Jerry wrote every single note on that album. If I know it's the Jerry I know, he wrote all of it. And so to this day, no one really buys the Raphael version anymore. It's definitely a Jerry, a Jerry song, you know. But I think it's amazing. I think it's an amazing song.
It's kind of a story song also, you know, about, I think he's talking about Baker Street in London and just, you know, coming down from Scotland and hanging out. And, you know, it's got kind of a, I mean, like, what's the story here? You know, there's stuff in there about how, you know, everything will be better next year. Right. But, you know, till now we just kind of roll along. And so it's kind of happy. And then it's kind of sad at the same time.
Yeah, no, he's got a dream about buying some land. He's going to give up the booze and the one-night stands because he's got a wife, he's got a kid. And he's going from Scotland, where he has this happy home life, down to London to deal with the lawyers trying to get extricated from the Steelers' wheels situation. He's crashing at a buddy's place on Baker Street so he doesn't have to stay in an expensive hotel or rent a place or whatever. So that's what he's doing, you know. And I remember when I moved to London and I first stopped at the Baker Street tube station, I was taking pictures and sending them to you. Like, here we are at Baker Street, man.
Right off the bat.
We're at Baker Street, yeah. Here's another strange story about Baker Street that obviously I didn't know anything about before we started doing this story. Okay, it went to number 2 on the Billboard chart, and it sat there for 6 weeks, and it was blocked by Andy Gibb's Shadow Dancing. Okay, it was supposed to go to number 1. Like, it was being played more. I mean, look, back in the day, they can just call anything they want number 1, number 2. They didn't have hard sales numbers like they do now, like it's all digitized and all that thing, or number of airplays and that kind of thing. It's just like, we think this one's at number 1, you know, and this one, no, that one's not number 1. That's probably number 3 or something like that. So I understand that. But the fact of the matter is, the industry rumor is that it did overtake Shadow Dancing. Okay, and Casey Kasem was going to put it at the top. However, at a dinner with Gibbs managers, then Billboard chart director Bill Wardlow was told if Shadow Dancing did not remain at number 1, then Gibb was going to be pulled from the lineup of the upcoming Billboard concert that they were putting on. So they left it at number 1, and they screwed Jerry and stuck him at number 2.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's an odd thing, because I mean, back then, the brothers Gibb could do whatever they wanted to. I feel that's odd that they would do that, but maybe because it was Andy and not the rest of them. But, well, yeah, that's kind of a kick in the pants.
Yeah, so Wardlow then calls the magazine, okay, change the print, just leave it at the top. And Casey apparently had to re-record his countdown. Now, some of that is disputed, so we don't know for sure. But it's a keen insight into how the music industry has worked and did work and probably still on some levels does work. But you can't take away, I mean, look, how did it do? Australia number 1, Austria number 4, Belgium number 9, Canada number 1, Ireland number 3, Netherlands number 9, New Zealand number 4, South Africa number 1, Switzerland 2, UK 3, US 2, maybe 1, West Germany 3, because it was West Germany back then. So sold 1 million copies in the United States, sold over 500,000 copies in the United Kingdom, more around the world. That's a huge, huge international hit, and it's an iconic song. And if you look on something like IMDb, that song and Stuck in the Middle with You have been used in like over 100 movies and TV shows. Everyone knows that song, and to this day, it really, really endures. I guess the first time I really saw it in a movie was Good Will Hunting. At that point, I already knew the song very well. I mean, that came out after we were in college. But I got a real thrill during the heady days of Napster, when I had a couple Foo Fighter albums, but I didn't have all of them. Plus, they had stuff that had been on soundtracks and stuff and some B-sides. So I'm like, oh, well, I'll jump on Napster and see what Foo Fighters stuff. And to my surprise, the Foo Fighters had covered Baker Street with somebody, I don't know if it was Dave or who, someone's playing, instead of the sax solo, it's a guitar solo. But the coolest, funniest part about it is, in the middle, he changes the lyrics slightly to, he's gonna give up the crack and the one night stands. He's got this dream about buying some land. He's gonna give up the crack and the one night stands. And then he'll settle down. It's a quiet little town and forget about everything. But you know it'll always be.
And you got to update it for the time.
I know, and I put it on several, because I used to make CDs and print the covers and everything for friends at like Christmas time and stuff like that. And I put that on several in the early 2000s because I'm like, this is a great song, and I know you guys like the Foo Fighters, so give a listen to this. It came out in, I guess it was released in 1998, and it was part of their UK single, CD single, My Hero. Of course, a CD single would often have about 4 songs on it, maybe 3. So the single, a B-side, and then maybe something live, or maybe another B-side, or a lost track, whatever. But yeah, it was during Color of the Shape sessions, and I think it eventually made it on a reissue or remaster or whatever. So Dave Grohl, the savior of rock and roll, loves Jerry Rafferty too, man. So.
And what would you rather listen to now? Would you rather listen to Baker Street, or would you rather listen to Shadow Dancing?
Yeah, that's so easy. My God. Andy Gibb, the forgotten Gibb.
Well, so if you say that about, and I haven't listened to Shadow Dancing in a while, so I'm just kind of going by memory.
It's just a disco song. That's all it is.
That's exactly what I was going to say. That sounds so dated. Yeah. Day and night difference.
Yeah. What I didn't know is, like, on the record, it's over 6 minutes long. They cut the single version down to just over 4 minutes, so they trimmed a lot out of the single version, at least the UK single version. I think the American 12-inch or 7-inch single might have been longer than that, but not as long as the album version.
Hi, this is Jeff Downs. You're listening to The Ugly American Werewolf.
All right, well, what's that, like a half hour on one song? We got to move along.
Yeah.
But, you know, like we were saying, once you've got one hit song, you're going to get another one on there, right? Aha had Take On Me, huge hit. Well, do they ever have another one? Yeah, that Sun Always Shines on TV was a minor hit after that.
Right.
You get one huge one, they've got to have a second one. But right down the line, like you said to me, I might have known that one better. Mm-hmm. I might have known it before. And to me, they kind of go hand in hand. And I think it's another great, great track by Jerry. You know, and again, it did pretty well on the charts.
Yeah. And this is one where there's a lot going on right off the bat. Like your head almost does two things at the same time, because you've got the guitar riff, but then you've also got the bass riff mm-hmm. going. And they have nothing to do with each other. They're two totally separate tracks, but they work together. But it's very complex. This is not an easy song.
With you there. I put a note on there too. I love the bass on this song. This is really solid bass in this song. And that was all played by one man. I mean, there was a lot of different people on this, but Gary Taylor played the bass on the whole record, you know, and they did really well. Again, it's about 4.5 minutes on the album. It's about 3.5 minutes on the single version. So not a huge shock there. Waiting for the Day, which is on the B side of the second side of the record, is the B side of the album. But that it wasn't released till July 27th of 78. So that's more than 5 months, 6 months between singles. Now, I know Baker Street's this enormous hit, and he probably had to go out and tour and do a lot of engagements, and that's kind of what you want out of a hit single. But it took them a while before they decided to release that. Now, the fact of the matter is, they did release, according to the notes on Wikipedia, City to City was released as the first single in 77 ahead of the release on the album on January 19th, 1978. Baker Street came out kind of as the first single once it was released. Right Down the Line was the third single, they say. So that's July. Home and Dry followed it. The Ark after that, and Whatever's Written in Your Heart after that as singles. So six singles off a 10-song record. But when you're selling millions and millions, you've got this huge international hit and then a good follow-up. I mean, that's kind of what happens.
Yeah, I was very surprised to see six singles off of this. I knew the big two. I figured you probably had maybe one or two more, but six out of 10, that's, you know, you're getting into hysteria territory at that point in time.
It's crazy, you know. Now, and again, it did well. 12 on the Billboard Hot 100, 8 on Cashbox. And apparently it had 4 non-consecutive weeks at number 1 on the Easy Listening chart in 78. And it did well in Canada, you know. I have always loved this song. Really have. Like you said, to me, I may have known this one better. I may have heard this one first or just known it better and then kind of put the two together. Like, oh, yeah, that's one guy. But it's kind of like when I hear Don't Fear the Reaper by Blue Oyster Cult, immediately after I want to hear Burning for You. You know, it's not the same record, but it's like those are their two big hits. And it's like, I love that song. Is there any more? Yeah, Burning for You, Let It Run, you know. And this is the same way. It just so happens they're right next to each other on the same record.
You don't have to do anything. Just sit there. It'll come right on next.
And if history's proven anything, I'm good at just sitting there. All right, so that's two big international hits. Did very well for him, you know. Again, I mean, not as big as Baker Street. It's hard to have anything as big as Baker Street, you know. But you're talking about getting the top 20 in the U.S. and number one on Adult Contemporary and top 10 around different territories around the world. It sells well, and it kind of propels him to kind of keep going in the right direction. The fourth song is City to City, and again, I think this is kind of influenced by his lifestyle, time having to travel, right, and not even necessarily travel to tour, but travel to take care of his legal business and then travel back home kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's a traveling song, but it's an upbeat one. I like it.
And it's, I don't want to say right down the line is slower because it's not, but it kind of is. So this is a gear change where we're moving on to the next thing. They kind of have a, like at the beginning, you're like, it sounds like, you know, it sounds like you're on a train. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that's the right. Exactly. This has a little bit of the 70s funk on it. Like you can tell that some of the other ones you maybe not be able to tell, but you could, this one was obviously recorded in the 70s to me. But yeah, it's just about him. You know, this is what's happening. I do what I have to do, and then I'm on the train back home. I can't wait. Mm-hmm. That's where I want to be. And you kind of feel like it's just, the whole song is just chugging along. Like you really feel like you are on a train.
Yeah, and the harmonica, which is delivered by Paul Jones, who was the lead singer of Manfred Mann in the 60s. Not the Manfred Mann Earth Band that our buddy Chris Slade was a part of in the 70s, but he was delivering that. I think it adds a nice little texture. At the end, it gets a little bit odd to me. It's got some odd, like you say, 70s stuff with a, yeah, I'm going home, and the background singers are doing their thing, but I still like it. And mm-hmm. honestly, this could have been the first song instead of the arc. The arc seems like the kind of song you wrap up a side with, not one you start the side with.
Yeah, I wonder why they didn't do it like that. It's upbeat. It gets it moving. It's the title track. I don't know. I don't know. I don't have any notes here as to why they're tracked in the way that they were, but that would make sense to me.
Well, you know, the arc's probably just something that Jerry was very proud of. Like, this is a composition, mm-hmm. and it has all these different pieces and parts, and it's beautiful, and it's what I want to start with. But the record company's like, well, we're not releasing that. We're starting it with City to City, and my guess is mm-hmm. the A&R people like, put that first. That's the good first song. But it still worked out for everybody at the end of the day.
Absolutely. So,
Now, the fifth song, which will have been the last song on the first side, Stealing Time, this is slow. Right. It's got the sweet keyboard at the beginning. It's got a little pedal steel or dobro on there. And it sounds to me like he's just singing about, he's just chilling because he can't do anything because of his record contract situation. Like, he knows he needs to get back out there.
Okay.
But he's just, you know, he's kind of in limbo. And he's like, you know, it's my own time. I'm stealing time, but the time is mine. And so it's like, I'm enjoying this time with my family, but I know I've got to resolve this legal situation. I need to get out there and work and do my thing. But
yeah, he's got a line in there about time to cross that line.
Time to cross that line.
To your point, is he waiting? Yeah, come on. Let me out of the box here.
In time, forgot about everything that needs my mind. Stealing time, I was stealing time. But now I know it's time to cross that line.
And that's what it sounds like to me. But it's a sweet song.
Yeah.
And I think this is kind of what he does best. Again, it's a fairly long song. It's over 5.5 minutes. City to City was about 5 minutes, you know. But to me, it's pretty strong, and it kind of wraps up a pretty strong first side of an album. A mega hit, a great follow-up hit, a good road trip song, and then a good lament song, along with the arc, which is, I don't know, it's kind of a traditional bluegrass picking thing that's a little different than the rest, but it's still a nice song. It wraps up a very interesting side one to this record.
There are no two songs that sound the same on this one. And this almost sounds, it's almost like a kind of gospel sounding deal with that organ at the beginning. So yeah, I like it. It works well. And I find it interesting that they put Baker Street right down the line 1-2. It's kind of that, you know, what do you hit them hard and catch them, or do you move it, you know, do you put one of those kind of on the backside to get them, somebody to listen to the whole thing all the way through?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, City to City is, you know, they put it fourth, could have been first, could have been 1-2-3 instead of 2-3-4. So this is definitely a little bit of a game changer as far as the mood and what he's talking about.
Yeah,
but then to open the second side, so is Maddie's rag, because it's got a fade in and a fade out. So it fades in and it builds up a little bit. And I think it's about coming back to his home and having Maddie, you know, welcome it and say, okay, close your eyes, I got a surprise. So I don't know if it's to his daughter, Martha. Maybe Maddie was one of her nicknames.
That's the what I was reading into it, yeah. This one's a little bittersweet, because it's, you don't know, is it happy, is it sad? He's happy to be back, but he's also sad because he realizes how long he's away from her.
Yeah, and that's tough for any parent, man. Yeah, absolutely. To me, honestly, on this one, I can hear a little bit of why some people compared his songwriting to Sir Paul McCartney's. You get the fiddles and the backup singers, they give it a little bit of a Beatles sound to it. There's a little bit of a quality there. You know, B.J. Cole's guy who played guitars and stuff on this, and he plays the dobro or pedal steel on this kind of thing. But there's also accordion, there's brass. I mean, there's so much going on.
Yeah.
On this song. My only downside to it was because it fades in and it fades out and there's a whole lot going on. It's almost like you didn't know how to start it and you didn't know how to stop it. Yeah. And it's only 3.5 minutes, whereas everything else is 4.5 to 6.5 minutes long. So it's like it's good enough. He wasn't sure exactly how to start it, finish it, or even in between, right?
It's almost like it's kind of an unfinished deal, like something you were kind of messing with, and they said, well, you know, hey, good enough, just throw it on there. But yeah, there is no start, there is no end, but the middle part, there's definitely something there,
right?
And it's one of those songs where the more that you listen to it, the more you hear, oh, okay, I hear something else going on there.
Yeah,
in the layers of the sound,
there's a lot going on. Again, it's not just like four guys, like, you know, bass guitar, drums, singing, and maybe, you know, a piano or another guitar. There's a lot of, there's accordions in there, there's all sorts of different stuff in there, you know. So and interesting song. You know, it was the B-side, right, to Write Down the Line. So they didn't release it, one of the four that was not released as a single, but got out there because it was a B-side. And I guess it's a song to his daughter, who is in charge of his estate now. The second song, Whatever's Written in Your Heart, I think this was released kind of as the last release off of it. You hear that. You hear that title. And you know, yeah, this is going to be a lament, right?
Yeah. And where the other songs had a lot of stuff going on, there's really not a lot going on here. It's just the piano and him at the beginning.
Yeah. And, it almost, piano opening. It almost sounds like this one sounds like almost a gospel song to me.
Yeah.
I also put on here, he has a very nice voice. Because you're right. Well, it's just, there's not a lot of other stuff going on to distract you from his voice. It really is just kind of him and the piano for the most part. Whatever's written in your heart, that's all that matters. You'll find a way to say it one day. I think this is a very personal song for him. I don't think he's singing this to someone about them. I think he's singing it about himself, and that he's the one who struggles with the booze and struggles with, you know, it's easy to sing a love song to thousands of people. It's hard to go up to someone and hold their hand and look them in the eye and tell you that I love you, kind of thing. And I think for him, it's like, yeah, he's got this talent, but he can't really express himself necessarily one-on-one, person-to-person, but he can write it and perform it. That's why he hid behind the booze for a long time, maybe. I don't know. I'm speculating a little bit there. I don't know him that well, but there's some sadness in this song, there's for sure.
Yeah. And I think Right Down the Line was written to about his wife at the time. And, you know, is this the thing too, where maybe, I don't know what was going on in the relationship. Is he saying, you know, trying to say, I've got these things, but I don't know how to express them.
Right.
Like you were saying, and not that it's not a problem with her. It's a problem with him. Yeah. How do I do this?
Exactly.
And, you know, you can talk, there's a line about how you can talk all night, but not say anything.
Exactly. You know, and why is he talking about, you know, he's going to give up the booze and the one night stands? Well, it's because he wants to be in a real relationship with a woman he loves, and the foundation of his life is his family. But he's got a foot in both worlds. And I remember being a young man, I would rather, instead of go up soberly and talk to a girl and tell her, this is how I really feel about you, I'd rather just get loaded and then see if she wants to make out. You know, that's that's a lot easier to do, you know. And if you get shot down, it doesn't matter, you know. Whereas if,
yeah, I didn't want to,
when you're sober, you know, and you say, hey, I really feel a lot for you, and she goes, get out of here, loser. Like, yeah, that would be hard to take. So I think that's what it is. 6.5 minutes. It's the longest on the record, dude. And it feels a little long in some places.
Whatever's written in your heart, that's all that matters. You'll find a way to say it all someday. Yeah. Whatever's written in your heart, that's all that matters. Yeah.
Yeah, and I was thinking about that too. But the more I listen to it, the more if you listen to what he's saying, it's really not that. It's not as long as you think it is. And I've got a note here. You know, is he giving up? Like, I can't do this anymore, or is he resigning himself that if he keeps working at it, it'll work out?
Good question.
I don't know.
Good question. And that's probably something he was struggling with, because he didn't know this was going to sell 6 million copies as an LP, and then millions more in singles. And I think, you know, it said something like, it made him £80,000 a year, Baker Street. Like, it was a nice annuity. Every year he got that much just from that song alone. So everything else that he did, he's like, I can just live off of that. He didn't have that yet. You know, he's still, he basically said, look, everything I did was a failure, right? I mean, the Humble Bums were a failure. My first solo album was a failure, and Steeler's Wheel was a failure. You know, it's like, I don't judge my life on record sales. You know, I judge it on the quality of my stuff. But then once you've got a big hit, your perspective might change a little bit.
Yeah. And I think this was definitely the one that brought him into it. But like you were saying, when you were recording it, I mean, the track record wasn't stellar so far. You don't know how this was going to go.
That's exactly right. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Now, the eighth song, or the third song on the second side, Home and Dry, I like this one. This is a lot more upbeat.
We're changing gears again. But the whatever's in your heart, that's heavy duty. Mm-hmm. Okay, we need something light. Let's go back to the traveling song. This time, though, we've got an upgrade. We're not on a train now. Now we're on the transatlantic flight. Ooh. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and it's positive. It's a positive song. It's not a lament like these others. And he's talking to his woman like he's, you know, he's going to be with her. It's all about her. He's happy to be home and dry instead of on the road or commuting to London or something like that. And this actually hit the Billboard charts as well. 28 on Billboard, 26 on Easy Listening. So that's three straight hits that he had on the American charts. That's not an easy thing to accomplish, you know. Not everybody does that, especially someone of this genre. I mean, if you were a disco artist, maybe then, yeah, it's easy to get three hits, you know, in a year. But to get three for Jerry Rafferty out of Scotland, that's rare.
Yeah. But now, wait a minute. What is he talking about? It's not raining on the plane. What do you mean you're going to be home and dry?
That's a very English turn of phrase.
Okay.
Like you're done and dusted. I'm home and dry, because it's always raining in England. But I got news for you. I've lived in Amsterdam for 4 months, and it has rained every goddamn day. Okay? It's rained so much more here than it did in London. And it's harder rain, too. Like, in London, you don't necessarily need an umbrella. You need a jacket, but you don't necessarily even need a hat. Here, you need all that stuff. It rains, and it rains, and it rains.
Okay. So the home and dry means you're the bit safe and sound, not I'm home.
Exactly.
I'm not going to be drinking anymore. Like, I'm not drying out from that.
I doubt that somehow.
Okay. Okay. But yeah, just to say, kind of the same thing as city to city. You know, I'm done doing what I have to do. I'm coming back home. I can't wait to, you know, be with the family, be with everybody, and just kind of get back to more of a normal life for a minute.
Yeah, exactly. And you know what? Did well in Canada, 23 overall, number 7 adult contemporary. But for whatever reason, they didn't release it as a single in the UK.
Hmm. Interesting.
Which is too bad. Maddie's Rag was the B-side, but I thought it was, I think this is a great song.
The silver bird takes me across the sky. Just one more ride. Tired, but I feel good, 'cause I do. did everything I said I would. I think of you and I know how you'll be feeling.
So, I mean, the first four releases, City to City, Baker Street, Right Down the Line, Home and Dry, these are great songs. These are killer, you know, song, good for the time. Couple of them are classics for all time. The one that's a little different to me is Island, the ninth song. Did he take a vacation? Wake up, my love. The sun is shining in the sky above. I'm like, huh? Is this Jerry Rafferty? You know, and
he's taking a swing at Jimmy Buffett on this.
Kind of, you know. You know, it's a little bit of a departure, not a huge departure in style, but as far as what he's singing about, it kind of is. I mean, did he write it while he was on vacation or reminiscing about a vacation?
That's what it sounds like. And it sounds like to me, I mean, and maybe it's one of those things too, like you tour for an extended period of time and I just want to go on vacation. The other thing too is what we don't really realize in the United States is that people from England and people from Scotland, all, like you said, it rains all the time. Right. To go to a place where the sun is shining and it's warm and that's everything you can hope for.
Yeah.
And my thing with this, just listening to this song, like it's just kind of a nice little escape song. But I know people that tell me like, oh, I don't like the beach. If you don't like the beach, I don't want to know.
Yeah, what's wrong with
because
you,
there's nothing better than just being on vacation, got your feet in the sand, the drinks are flowing, and it's just
sunny.
Living is easy. Oh, geez.
I understand maybe you don't want to live at the beach. I can get that. Mm-hmm. Like that's not what you want all the time. You want different terrain. Sure. You want different climate. Okay, I get it, but you never want to go there. And I find, people from England, because of their weather situation, those folks travel the world, man. I mean, first of all, they once conquered it and owned it and ran the whole thing. But, I'll be talking to a cab driver. He's like, oh, yeah, every year I go for 2 weeks to the Azores. I'm like, well, I don't know if I can afford to go to 2 weeks from the Azores. I do a little bit better than a cab driver, But, I mean, that's just their culture. They will go travel all over the world, to the most far-flung places sometimes. That's just kind of part of it. And Ravenscroft is back on this one. He did a little sax number on this. So it's this and Baker Street. But he's talking about this is the last day. And it's like, we got to soak this up while it lasts. I'm like, this is weird for Jerry Rafferty.
Right, but in some weird way it fits. I couldn't tell you why. It's totally different. It completely fits. I will tell you, back to the vacation thing, I've sat at a table full of Brits, and it's like the business card scene from American Psycho. They're trying to one up each other with vacations. Where are you going to go? Well, I'm going to South Africa. I'm going to the Maldives.
Exactly.
Hey, we get it.
Yeah.
Vacation is important. We get it. But again, if you live in a place where it rains and is overcast, that's all you want to do is get away.
Absolutely.
And like I said, I don't know why it works, but it totally does.
It does. It's not way off. It's not a departure of style so much. It's just a departure of kind of what he's singing about. Yeah.
Right. The kind of the
story
message,
is a little different. Yeah, absolutely. Now, last song on the album, Waiting for the Day, which was a B-side, I guess. This is upbeat. It's got a little 70s disco tinge to it.
I have
it.
That note too. Yeah.
Especially with the guitar. Yeah. And the guitar on here is from Andy Fairweather Lowe, who had played with Clapton and, a lot of different guys over the years. And a talented guy. But it's kind of got that 70s chug disco guitar. And then, he plays it pretty well. And the beat is very disco. But here's the thing. I like it. And to be honest with you, it can easily be flipped with the arc. Now, how often did you say you could flip the first song with the last song?
Not at all. Usually the last song
is the last song for a reason. Yeah.
Yeah. Correct.
Either because it's not good and barely made the record, or because it's a nice little soft way to kind of sing you out, which to me, the arc kind of would have been. It's not like it's the worst song or it's a bad song, but it's like, here's one that's kind of mellow to kind of see you on your way, and we'll sing Okay. Yeah. You know, that would be a good way to wrap it up. To me, though, Waiting for the Day, as far as the 10th song goes, is pretty good. It could have easily been the first song because it's upbeat and it has that kind of disco thing, which at the time may have helped it sell even more. You put that on first versus the Ark. Like, you buy it because of Baker Street and you hear the Ark and you're like, oh, what did I get in here? But it's 1978 and you buy it and then that comes on. You're like, okay, you know, you're talking my language here, right?
I like that. You're right. The tune is 70s, got 70s funk all over it. The guitar work is really nice. My criticism for this one is the lyrics. They're just kind of throwaway, whereas a lot of these other ones had very personal, like, you could tell this was just kind of like, we need some words to go on along with this music. Okay, I'll throw something together for you.
And maybe that's why it's last, because it was the least strong or least compelling story of it, even though and you know, look, he wasn't a disco guy. So having that disco track on there, he's kind of like, okay, that's not really me. I want that lower. But that's just my take on it. You could put this first and put the Ark last, and I think the flow of the album would be better.
Yeah, I will agree with you that while I like the song The Ark, it is a very strange way to start the record. Like, this is how you want, this is the statement you want to make off the bat,
right,
which makes me believe that he felt very passionately about that track, and that's why he said, I don't care,
This puts it number one. And maybe it was one that had been sitting around the longest, and he's like, okay, I've been fighting this legal battle for 2 or 3 years just so I can get this song, you know, out, you know, kind of thing.
Maybe.
So, who knows? Yeah. I don't know. But that was the album put together. However, there was the B-side to, I think it was Baker Street. Big Change in the Weather. Now, I had never heard this song before doing research for this show. So I'm like, okay. B-side, Big Change in the Weather. Let's listen to it. It's about a 5.5-minute song. It sounds nothing like anything else on this album. Absolutely nothing. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if it was produced differently or in a different space or whatever.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay.
It sounds nothing like it. It's very tinny. And you know what I mean when I say tinny, but it means it's high in treble, low on bass. Mm-hmm. And the rest of the album sounds great. Like, it's mixed very well. Even those songs are different kinds of songs. They all sound the same to me. And it's very fast. So it doesn't fit it at all. After doing research and found that the US record was played at a faster rate, I thought, okay, well, maybe this is too. And the only real version of this is the US version. And that's why it sounds faster and sped up. The drums don't sound like anything else on the album. So I don't know. It's very weird. But here's the thing. His voice sounds the same to me. And it's not like they would speed up the song and have him do his voice over it. They would have sped up the whole thing.
Right.
So if that's the case, then it's a real anomaly to me. It doesn't make a lot of sense.
I don't know whether this was, I was just trying to look and see if there's any kind of note on this. It could have been something that was, it didn't get recorded originally with the rest of the sessions, but he still liked it for whatever reason. Yeah. So they did it somewhere else. I don't know, but it does have a different feel to it.
Totally different.
And you wonder why they would even include that. I mean, I know B-sides are, that's what they are.
They're something,
you know, something
away.
That's not correct. Yeah. But that is interesting.
Yeah. I mean, maybe it was like, okay, but we'll just pick one of the songs of the album. Like, no. We know Baker Street's going to be a big hit. Let's, you know, back it with something horrible, you know, that nobody's going to want, you know, isn't even good enough to go on the record, you know? So maybe they made that song, they mixed everything else. And like, okay, that's not going to make it on the record. So we're not even going to mix that. That's not going to sound the same. And they're like, okay, well, now we need a B-side. Okay, here it is. You know, the one that doesn't sound right. I mean, the drums are way off. I don't know. And then in reading, because I had to find it on YouTube, they don't even have it on Spotify. I found it on YouTube.
Huh. Okay.
And there's a bunch of comments in there, like, you know, hey, this is from City City. He goes, wasn't on my City City. Like, no, it was a B-side or whatever. He's like, and some people are like, thanks, this just doesn't fit. And I had to like that one. I'm like, you're right. It doesn't fit. And I guess, you know, there's some stuff in there like, I hope you know who your friends are and some of that kind of stuff. And like, oh, I think he's singing to Billy Connolly on this. I'm like, I don't know. Billy seems like they resolve things, and he seems a little bit more easygoing. I got a feeling it's more like he was singing it to Joe Egan, like, you got stuck with those Americans who were screwing us over, and like, hope you know who your friends are. Or maybe he's even singing it to himself, like, you know, I'll know better next time. I won't get involved with those people I don't trust, kind of thing. I doubt it was about Billy, but who knows? We don't know. And Jerry's been gone now for over a decade, I guess it is.
Yeah.
He made a couple records after this one. They didn't come anywhere close to the success of Baker Street. I mean, you know, like not even anywhere close. But he continued on. And when you have that one big seller, right, you're going to get more chances. I mean, it's not just that you have an obligation to fulfill. You've got an opportunity to go out there and
right.
do well.
You've got the track record where they will keep letting you make records.
Yeah. You know, so Night Owl comes out the next year, and the single Night Owl, I think, does okay, but doesn't, you know, run up the charts or anything. I think it goes gold in the UK, but that's like 100,000. Whereas, you know, Baker Street sold 600,000 on its own, not to mention the whole record, you know? So I think the song Night Owl did fine. Days Gone Down, which I seem to remember it was used in a pretty big movie or TV show in the last 5 or 6 years or something like that, probably because it's a lot less expensive than trying to get Baker Street or Steeler's Wheel, you know. So Night Owl does, you know, okay. Snakes and Ladders comes out in 1980. I don't think that really goes anywhere at all, to be honest with you. And then in 1982, they're Sleepwalking. And then I think he's, you know, at this point, he's been working hard, touring, interviews, recording, promoting, and he's like, I gotta change the way I do this.
Well, the other thing too is you were talking about, you know, if you're making a guaranteed 80K a year off of one song, all of a sudden, maybe I'm not really so interested in beating my head against the wall anymore. I'll just kind of sit here, and when I want to work, I work, and when I won't, I'll do whatever.
Yep. And that was kind of the case, I think, you know. And look, between 1988 and 2009, the time of his death, he put out 6 records, and including one that I picked up. It was kind of his last one, called Rest in Blue. It came out, I was going to say last year, but it was 2021, so technically it was 2 years ago. His daughter, Martha, kind of cobbled together the demos and stuff that was intended to be his next album that would come out in 2011 or maybe 2012. And they released Rest in Blue. And so I picked it up because I support Jerry and want to know more about his career than just, you know, the one record, you know. And
right.
Look, there's some nice stuff on there. There's no doubt about it. But none of it recaptures the magic that was this time and place. And that's sometimes what an album is. It may be classic, and the songs you may continue to love your whole life, but I don't know. If I play a few of these songs to, like, my daughter's class as a bunch of 8 and 9-year-olds, are they going to say, oh, yeah, that's awesome, and they'll love it the rest of their lives? Probably not, but because we heard it on the radio growing up when we were so impressionable, they've put it in movies and stuff that we love, and then we listened to it, you know, when we were older. I just feel like it's a generational thing. It's important to us and our age group, but beyond that, maybe not so much.
Yeah, you're right. It imprinted, and then when it came back around again, you say, oh, you know, I remember this. And then, you know, you go back and you listen to the album again, or you listen to the tracks that you like. But yeah, I think now it's just, not only do they not have a connection, but we've talked about this before, music is just so much more disposable now. Like, it's just, you know, you don't ever get to know anything. It's just, you know, onto the next thing.
Yeah.
The one thing I did want to say about the record is that Jerry's voice, he didn't have a big range, at least not that was on display, but he makes up for it by having different sounding songs, different styles of songs. So nothing sounds repetitive on this record at all.
I like that. I think you're onto something there. You're right. He didn't have this huge 8-octave range or anything like that. He kind of had this one little pocket that he was in, but it was nice. It was melodic. It was pretty. It was soulful.
Yeah. And if you change the style up, then you don't have, like I said, you don't have repetitive thing like, oh, this just sounds like the last one. And him putting the different instruments in and layering it, I don't think any two songs sound the same on this record at all.
And yet it together makes a lot of sense together to me. Mm-hmm. You know, except for the arc, I'm just telling you, great song. It's just weird. Make it the 10th song instead of the first. Again, John Byrne did the cover painting. Look, I love it, and I like being able to get to know an artist like Jerry Rafferty, who's not AC/DC, who's not, you know, hard rock, or who made, you know, a dozen albums of which they all had some kind of hit on it. It's cool to be able to dig in and find an artist like this. But the fact of the matter is, Jerry was not a superstar personality. It's not what he wanted to be. In that documentary, there's a video of him like getting an award at like the British Musician and Songwriting Award or whatever kind of thing. He goes up, he's got his glasses on, his untrimmed beard on, his jacket, no tie. How do you feel? I feel really great. You know, it's like, if he wasn't singing or playing, he really didn't have a whole lot to say. It seemed. Now, I think he was shy.
Yeah.
But you know, the fact of the matter is he had a drinking problem and his father succumbed to drinking. And I think in the late 80s, maybe 88 or something like that, one of his older brothers died. I don't necessarily think it was alcohol related, but I think it hit him hard and it didn't help his drinking. And not too long after that, he got divorced from his wife who he had been with for so long. And then he would generally end up in the papers because he would destroy a hotel room or he would, you know, get blotto somewhere, or, you know, get in trouble in the United States or something like that. And so I hate that that is a big part of his legacy. But that's kind of the tale of Jerry Rafferty, is that he had one enormous hit record. He had some other successes. He lives on because of about three songs. Mm-hmm. And there was something about himself that he was not thrilled about. And I think that's what the alcohol was about.
Yeah. And that's always kind of the back and forth is you hate to hear that about a person, but that's what makes somebody great to write songs, because they've got this pain that they can convey. Mm-hmm. And you may not have the same problems, but you can relate to what he's saying. You can relate to the things that he's gone through, the concepts of it. And it's interesting that this album was not bigger in the United States, because there's a lot of great tracks on here that never get heard. And why this wasn't pushed harder, maybe it was because of him. You know, he wasn't the guy that was going to come here and do a months-long tour in the United States and get on TV and hype it and everything. So they just said, okay, we'll play what we're going to play, and then that's just it.
He didn't love to tour. He certainly didn't love to do interviews.
Right. But look, and that kills you in the United States. You have to be a personality to make it.
Kills you everywhere, really. I mean, but that said, how did the album do? Number 3 in Australia, 9 in Austria, 5 in the Netherlands, 3 in Germany, 6 in New Zealand, 6 in the UK, number 1 US Billboard 200, number 1 that summer, you know. So, and it went platinum. Didn't go multi-platinum, but getting platinum in the United States after being basically a nobody in the era of punk and disco, not to mention big rock like Led Zeppelin, AC/DC, that kind of stuff, that's pretty damn good. I mean, number 38 overall on the 1978 chart for the year.
Yeah, very decent showing. Like I said, I don't know why this wasn't bigger in the United States, because I think the material is there.
It just kind of depends on where you were. You know, I mean, are you a Kiss fan? Uh-huh. If you're Kiss, you probably don't like this. You know, if you're a prog, Genesis fan, you probably don't like this. You know, if you like Al Stewart, Year of the Cat, this is probably, you know, your kind of thing. You like Neil Diamond, this is probably your kind of thing, you know. So Christopher Cross, my guess is you do like this, you know. So I'm just glad it came out in the late 70s, because it came out 3 or 4 years later, or the dawn of MTV. It never would have had a chance.
Right. And I'm glad that these two songs were on there to kind of spur us on to listen to the rest of the record and get to know Jerry a little bit better. Other than that, you wouldn't have heard of him at all.
That's right. That's right. So God rest you, Jerry. And thanks so much for what you did do, because we're fans, and Dave Grohl's a fan. You know, you have legions of fans. It's just you didn't really want to get out and play for him. You want to be recognized for your talent. You just didn't want to have to pay the dues of the road there. Yeah.
Hey, it's Kate Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Well, that wraps show number 113 on Jerry Rafferty and his 1978 record, City to City, which featured the big hits, Baker Street and Right Down the Line. And we hope you enjoyed our little trip down memory lane there. And for those of you who aren't as familiar with Jerry Rafferty as you should be, hopefully this gives you a little impetus to go out there and listen to his stuff. You know, it's not just that one record. He did make a bunch of others. Of course, he was also in Steeler's Wheel, but go out and check out Jerry, a Scottish legend of sorts who had some big hits there in the late 70s. He's no longer with us, but definitely left a mark on us. And it's nice to take a break from the hard rock and the heavy metal that we usually listen to and dive into maybe somebody who isn't necessarily a household name, but those songs are household songs. Definitely everybody knows Baker Street. Most people know Right Down the Line. Stuck in the Middle with You. Thanks to Quentin Tarantino is a in the public zeitgeist. And so hopefully our little show on Jerry will help you become more familiar with his work and appreciate him more. And so we want to know, as usual, folks, do we get something right? Do we get something wrong? Do we miss the point? Do we leave out your favorite part? You have got to let us know. You email us at uglyamericanwerewolf@gmail.com. You can also tweet or DM us at ugly_werewolf or at actionjack72. You can let us know the albums, the bands, the concerts, the rock and roll that you want to hear us talk about. And of course, we want you to download and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, be it Apple, Spotify. Good Pods is very good to us. It sounds like Google Play might be going away, but wherever you get your podcast, please download, subscribe, and if you're thinking about it, give us a positive review. It just takes a second, and it really makes a big difference to us. It helps us find more rock and rollers like you and helps us grow our show. Thanks, as always, to Pantheon Pards, of which we are a proud member. And, of course, thanks to our incredible sponsor, RareVinyl.com. So if you want to go out and find that rare Jerry Rafferty 12-inch single, or maybe you want to get the City to City album, an LP, a first print, go to RareVinyl.com, use code PODCAST. You'll save 10% off not only that order, but every order you make going forward. Now, next week, we're going to do a band that's a little bit more well-known to you, I have a feeling. An album celebrating its 40th anniversary here very soon, and that's U2's War, which had the huge hits Sunday Bloody Sunday and New Year's Day. It's a really pivotal album for the band. It really started them on the path to mega stardom. It's a big one for us, and we hope that you enjoy listening to that. You'll have to download and subscribe to make sure you don't miss that. So until next time, to all of you rock and rollers all around the world, be cool and stay safe.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.